Hello, I'm Helen Please, and welcome to another episode of Cyber Show on the Go. In these episodes, we escape the studio into the countryside and talk about tech while we relax. This episode features Andy Farnell and Ed Navard walking and talking in the picturesque New Forest countryside, where they discuss education and hacking and the ethics of unfettered access to red team training. Can cybersecurity training be considered ammunition? Ed and Andy talk about tech anxiety and the general fear people have in losing their phones, the problem of information overload, mental health issues, AI, and the spectacular failure of modern systems in our age. This episode was recorded on the 16th of June, 2023.
Oh, put it in that little front pocket.
Yeah, put these guys into the side pockets.
Okay.
That's good. Because then the antennas are poking up, which is kind of quite nice.
Doesn't look like you're walking around with a bottom at all. If you see something that doesn't look right.
Every time I'm on the train with Kate and the Senate, it goes, you see something that doesn't look right.
So yeah.
It goes, your face.
Yeah.
In this segment, Ed and Andy discuss why universities who sell cybersecurity training to overseas students might not have our national security as a priority.
Is this in relation to you quitting?
What's the word I'm looking for? Sense of isolation.
Well, I think in terms of the university, it's not the first and won't be the last time, and they don't really care.
They don't care, and they don't care about why.
No.
And it's the about why bit that bugs me.
Yeah.
It was Dan that said this, but I kind of really worked for me. He said, don't you feel a bit like those, the flight instructors, the flying instructors, before 9/11, when students turned up and said, yeah, we really want to learn how to fly planes, but we're not very interested in how to land them. They said, that's it. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
Students who want to do only red team stuff,
yeah,
who come from Jordan or Syria, and they're not interested in learning the blue team
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Hold on. Yeah. And I kind of had that with some of the Nigerians as well. They were really interested, won't turn up for,
yeah,
for white hat.
You think, hang on a minute, where's half the class gone? And then it's the next class, and then the next class. And you think, oh, I haven't seen them since we started this.
So many of the Nigerians were absolutely lovely.
Yeah.
And Helen had them all sussed in the first couple of weeks, I think. And it's kind of sorted into, you know, the fraud gang group, who were all, like, pulling various ruses and scams and things like that. And the people who were recruitable. So that deafness kind of started to get to me quite a lot. And I tried and tried and tried and tried. I must have written like 24 emails to trying to escalate things over the years. And every single time I just get crickets, tumbleweeds blowing across the savannah.
Yeah.
And they're absolutely not interested.
Yeah.
And I can see why. I mean, it goes against the profit motive of the university.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just one university, though. It's the whole country, in a sense. Or not even country, it's a whole worldwide problem in higher education. And I was speaking to one of my mum's friends who used to work for a university as a lecturer and said exactly all the same things as you did.
Okay.
They don't care about the students, they just care about the money. And that was 10 years ago that she quit. And it was because of the same reasons as you.
When it's, I don't know, Marxist feminist studies, I don't mind. But when they're teaching, to me, this is it's a matter of national security.
Yeah.
And you can't do that.
No.
You can't. We're basically selling arms from UK classrooms. Because if you think of, like, cyber skills as an armament.
Yeah.
Why not? I mean, the US government been stupid enough to try and classify encryption as a munition. I would say cyber skills would count as an armament.
Oh, so definitely, yeah.
Selling armaments from UK classrooms indiscriminately, someone needs to look at that. So anyway, I approached the Times main newspaper and The Spectator as a follow-up and said, look, I've just resigned from a British university on ethical grounds. I've tried for a very long time to raise issues and been absolutely deflected and knocked back, shut down. In the end, we're selling arms from UK classrooms to hostile foreign regimes because they're overseas students and they're very, very profitable. And a lot of them will just go back. We at the pub was having was, and after they'd had a little a bit to drink, one or two of them had kind of pretty much blabbed that they were here at the behest of their cyber, their government cyber offence groups to learn as much as they could about about UK procedures and practices and knowledge, take that all back.
Yeah, because
Well, let's not name any.
Well, I'm not going to name anyone. No, I think it was an Indian student, and someone had sponsored him privately to come and do this course. And Helen sort of made a joke, saying, "Oh, we know what you're going to go and do with this." Then, and he just laughed and said, "Don't tell anyone."
But even if that wasn't going on. Let's just say take a random cross-section of mature students, let's say like over 24.
Yeah.
Who've gone on to a cyber skills course, cyber security course, that involves ethical hacking.
Yeah.
With the sure and absolute certainty that they're going to get a lovely high-paying job afterwards because they've been told that again and again. And many of them will, for sure.
Yes,
But those that don't are very quickly going to discover that their skills are highly desirable.
Oh, yeah.
By all kinds of people.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Why do you think the government aims to hire hackers that have been arrested and things like that? Because they want to get them, you know, the skills are amazing.
Right, so I mean, that's the finishing school. You've done your master's course, now go and work in the criminal underworld, ripping off old ladies for 5 years, and then maybe we'll kind of employ you at GCHQ. Is that kind of what's going on? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's through, you know, you see a lot of articles related to hacking, they're all negative when we think about the general media.
In the general mass media, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's no wonder that people think of malicious attacks when they think of the word hacking.
So, well, we don't have a word then, if you kind of just factor out the entire hacker culture.
Well, you put one word in front of it and it's ethical.
It's ethical, and that is the most devious. That's the most devious slight ever.
Yeah.
Most of all because there is absolutely no trace of ethics on an ethical hacking course whatsoever.
No.
We have never discussed, you know, Kantian postulates or universalizability or, you know, John Stuart Mill. Where was that on the course? It wasn't there, was it?
No. No, I think it's these courses aren't designed with those things in mind. And I think it needs a lot of careful consideration that it's not there currently.
It's lipstick, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's lipstick that they put onto the course to soften it for all those mums who are paying for their kids to go to university and say, oh, you're going to do a course in hacking? Oh, dear, no, I'm not sure about that. Oh, no, mum, it's ethical hacking. Oh, was it? Oh, yes, we can only use our powers for good. So, yeah, that's a cosmetic bit. No matter how many times I tried to do that officially, to get the funding, to get the extra hours and say, look, we're going to actually do the ethics part.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a sniff of interest whatsoever.
No.
Why would you want to do that? Well, so that our students don't go out next year and become cyber criminals.
Yeah.
Because eventually there's got to be some blowback, hasn't there?
Yeah.
There's got to be some gang and say, well, we all studied at like such and such a university and we all met each other there and decided to form a massive extortion gang.
That's going
to to pay off our student fees.
That's going to affect the ranking of the university.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, all of that. So that's been on my mind quite a lot. That I need to do something to sort of ease my conscience a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're in the middle of writing that Ethics for Hackers book,
aren't you? Of course, the book, right? Yeah, that's.
So I think this would be your sort of journey through higher education in relation to cybersecurity, I think, is a really important thing to include in that.
Right, it's eye-opening, absolutely, yeah.
And it gives huge context, especially to people outside of the whole higher education industry.
And the fact that it's an industry.
Yeah.
That it's a training industry.
Yeah. Well, I'd be lying if I didn't say they're making profit, not making profit from it.
Yeah.
In this segment, Ed and Andy are talking about cybersecurity as an arms race, as a war in which there are only losers. Can there be such a thing as cyber disarmament?
And I think when there's money involved, like anything, it can have negative effects. And when it's people's education and their futures, then that's like one of the worst. That's really bad.
There's a whole lot of perverse incentives going on, isn't there?
Yeah.
And not just the greed for money, but the arms race, what am I going to call it, fallacy. Arms races are a psychological phenomenon that happens simultaneously with two parties. It's two paranoid people,
yeah,
both thinking that the other one's plotting against them, yeah, and that they need to murder them first.
Yeah,
kind
yeah
of thing. And arms races, wherever they crop up, are very, very, almost more destructive than the wars that follow.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of wisdom that the Soviet Union was bankrupted, really, by trying to compete in the nuclear arms race.
Yeah.
I don't know how true that really is, but it's an interesting kind of angle on it.
Yeah, it just sort of reminds me that these organisations, when they're so busy trying to fight each other, they're actually self-imploding, because all of the energy goes into fighting external problems that don't exist, possibly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's almost like in Romeo and Juliet, where she drinks the potion.
Oh, I like that.
And
that's
then,
a really good metaphor, yeah.
And then he comes around and he's like, oh, no.
Oh, no. I've got to drink death, love, suicide potion as well.
It's exactly like that. But, yeah, they're too narrow-minded to see it. And if you put all those resources and energy into good things and positive developments and...
Well, it's hard to when you have a parasitical industry that's sort of feeding on the middle. There's that old Cohen of, what's the definition of a lawyer? Is two farmers fighting over a cow. One has got pulling the back legs and the other one's pulling the front legs.
Yeah.
In the middle is the lawyer milking it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that to some extent the cybersecurity industry is positioned, it's just evolved, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's evolved at a juncture that encourages arms races.
Yes, yeah.
Benefits greatly from them.
Yeah.
And so de-escalation or disarmament. What about cyber disarmament as a concept?
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's a very interesting... You put down yours and I'll put down mine.
You drop your weapon.
Well, obviously completely unverifiable, but then...
It's literally like a Mexican standoff, isn't it? Because no one wants to drop their guns.
Right.
And they think if they do, then they're going to get shot. You almost need some psychotherapist to sort of walk in the middle and go, come on, guys, how have we got to this point?
And they go, oh, yeah, I really love you. Yeah, I love you too. Yeah, let's just make babies.
Yeah.
Well, in the SALT, Strategic Arms Limitation Talks, and there's a load of this in Ross Anderson's book.
Mm.
And it doesn't, you don't think about it until you read it and you go, oh, yeah, shit, how does that actually work? Right? When the Russians say, we've destroyed 200 of our nuclear missiles and we've only got 50 of this other one, etc. How do you know that? And so the verification process is really elaborate.
Yeah, because there's no trust involved, is there, really? It's sort of someone else's word.
This is a complete procedural zero trust system of people in suits running around the world with briefcases, inspecting sites, looking at things, satellites. It's that the verification process for the disarmament is bigger than the arms industry that built the nukes in the first place.
Yeah, exactly,
right?
Yeah.
But there's a prospect in cybersecurity. I don't know, I mean, is there even an analogy? But it's worth thinking about. You can verify a potential enemy's technology.
Yeah, but we're stuck in this zero trust situation. You see it in cybersecurity marketing from big companies. It's like, oh, make sure you've got a zero trust policy, which is essentially an organisational body of some sort company saying, no, we're not going to let anything in unless it's been proved. And there's no approval process. It's sort of, we're just going to assume that's
but
bad.
But there is a difference between a functioning zero trust policy
of course,
and total lockdown. And lots of organisations have basically got total lockdown and they call it a zero trust policy because they don't understand what zero trust really is.
Yeah.
And they just think, it's just never doing anything ever.
And I'm not saying that, denial in a firewall by default is bad, because that's the opposite, that's really good. But it's from the human side of things. Just assuming that everything's bad and the problems that causes for people in the companies and organisations that are writing these policies.
Yeah.
And they're all destructive, almost all of them.
I think the sort of toxic end point of that is an economic failure.
So
you can't innovate, you can't communicate.
Yeah.
everything in and out is so shut down. Your IT, your cyber department become an unassailable, unaccountable power centre inside the organisation that's not even, that doesn't fit into the existing structure.
Yeah.
It becomes a kind of shadow entity, which by its policies tells even the CEO like what who he can talk to.
Yeah.
And then you get people who are so ignorant of security that the very word security is a conversation stopper for them.
Yeah.
So they'll say, oh, I just need to consult IT on that. And they say, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I'm the fucking CEO.
Yeah.
Like, you don't tell me what I can and can't do.
Yeah.
Like, you guys work for me, remember?
Yeah.
And they say, well, sir, I would strongly advise you. Like, well, yeah, in that kind of slippery language. And in no time at all, you've got a company that's ruled by a kind of rogue power centre. And then it kills it.
Yeah.
It kills it because you can't do deals with people anymore. Because all business relies on trust.
Mm. Yeah.
You can't have zero trust.
Yeah.
So if those zero trust values have leaked out of your security system, it's poison.
Yeah. I think that comes with, you need some balance from the CEO. He needs to be aware as well, or she, of the issues that, you know, potential threats.
Yeah, but how are they going to know? Are they well educated or not?
Well,
or,
that's the thing, isn't it?
Do they just trust the IT guy?
Yeah.
He says, we run a zero trust policy here, sir. Trust me on this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's what happened at the university. For example, when my cyber guys couldn't. So we're teaching cybersecurity, but my guys couldn't download Kali Linux.
Yeah.
They couldn't even visit the website.
Yeah.
They couldn't, and the people there that couldn't download, or access any websites that were to do with any sort of banned keywords.
Yeah.
I mean, at a university where grown-ups are doing PhDs on child abuse and things like that, that ceased to be a functioning university at that point.
Yeah.
You know, you have to bring in your
own. They just put these catch-all policies and don't consider the issues they cause.
Absolutely. You know, your students there with their own 5G phones because they can't access the research tools that they need. So what should we call that then? That phenomenon and sort of solutions to it? Like something on the limits of cybersecurity?
Yeah, it's... Well, that's a word that sums up the whole situation, is it? It's sort of limiting.
Ah, I see. It's limiting. Yes. It's limiting. What it does is...
Or prohibiting.
It plays to an ideal, or an idea, which I think is wrong. And that idea is that there's always a trade-off between security and freedom. That freedom and security are kind of flip sides of the same thing. And I think that's absolute BS.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that there is something that does stand in opposition to freedom, but it's a twisted version of security. Because real security always gets you freedom.
Yeah.
Otherwise, why? What are you having it for?
Yeah, yeah.
Real security buys you more freedom.
Well, yeah, it's almost like putting sun cream on and being able to walk around in the sun all day. That's what cybersecurity policy should be.
Yeah.
They're a layer of protection to enable the organisation to be openly available to the people that need to access it.
Okay.
Free of prohibition.
The word you used then was enable.
Yeah.
It's enabling security.
It's enabling, yeah.
And therefore, in opposition to that, is there disabling security? I think that's what the disease is.
Yeah.
But we've got a problem. It's disabling security rather than enabling security.
Yeah.
Okay. That's nicer. Okay. So we can.
Yeah.
There's the idea of the limits to cybersecurity, and that it's somehow in the balance of enabling and disabling kind types of security.
Yeah. I think that's just fundamentally what we're trying to get at.
In this segment, Ed and Andy revisit the topic of mental health and working in tech.
And despite the doctors telling me that there's things they have and I've got the hard data, the technical side of me is saying, oh yeah, you know, I've looked over it myself like a doctor would and like gone through it, or I'm like, yeah, that's completely fine.
Yeah.
Doctors have told me it's fine. But there's still a part of the emotional side of my brain that's tricking it into not believing it. So then it's like causing physical symptoms like today, where it's literally...
So it's become the cause of the symptoms.
Yeah.
And the symptoms become the cause of the anxiety, which feeds back.
But even as I'm saying that, I don't 100% believe it. That's the problem.
Right.
It's like...
This is such a good analogy for so many things that are going on with disinformation and general societal anxiety.
Yeah.
people get into a frenzy of believing the Russians are about to invade, or that some scientists have cooked up a virus in a lab. And in no time at all, that has fed back into real symptomology. Even sort of civil unrest and things like that going on.
It's definitely, that's the problem with this. It's like, it's the same thing with phones if you look at it too much, especially when it's your own health and you've got data about your, like a million points of data on your own health. You have to set boundaries, and that is where it's becoming like, there's actually a, there was a study where this is causing hypochondria in like, a huge amount of population.
Smartwatches with giving medical data are kind of leading to hypochondria.
Because the physiological symptoms of anxiety, which is fast heart rate, like shortness of breath, there's thousands of them. Loads of people have all sorts of different stress symptoms.
Yeah.
They can, like, one symptom could be a thousand different, like, actual problems.
Yeah.
But it's mostly probably stress.
Yeah.
But people are like, oh, the watch says that, like, I'm sat down and my heart rate's 120, what the, you know. And then that then starts the spiral effect. And that's what, you know, there's... Same with phones and social media, it's like, but that's in a different way. It's not health-related, it's... But there's a... You can... All of the problems point to the technology in one way or another. But, yeah, I just have to set boundaries because it's so easy for me to just, like... thinking, oh no, I haven't seen what my heart rate is in 3 minutes, you know, where I've taken it off of the main screen at one point, so I literally have to physically go like that, go into the settings and find it if I'm that desperate.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's
you pick a metric and you optimize for it, and the system adjusts to it just makes that metric, the measurement of that metric becomes the function of the system.
Yeah.
It's almost, it's kind of related to the error of paperclip maximization. but it happens within organizational dynamics. But also, a guy called Deming, who was I think I mentioned him before. Yeah, Deming was a sort of process engineering guy, quality control engineering. And he kind of figured out something like, well, he called it the American disease. Or he had the seven deadly sins of optimization.
Yeah.
And one was just like the disease of measurement. Is that you believe that you can measure everything and that whatever you measure is valuable data.
Yeah.
And then the act of measurement, that kind of itself becomes an obsession. And you end up putting all your energy into your telemetry and nothing into your actual production.
Yeah,
you know everything about
You know everything, but do nothing.
Is there something like that is going on, I think, with wearable, with smart technology?
Especially the wearable stuff that's like 24/7. There was a study on like detachment from it, and it was like some people. They did a study of. I have to find the article, but there was loads of people that, like, if they didn't have their watch on, they were just freaked out and scared because it became part of their, like, safety mechanism, where if they don't have access to their heart data or whatever for, like, 10 minutes and they know that it's not monitoring them, it's like being hooked up to a hospital. Like, if they're not hooked up to a hospital machine, they're scared and they're, like, going to die or whatever. But they, as soon as they take it off because they have to charge it, they're like, oh, no. I have to sit here for 20 minutes.
That's pretty pathological.
Yeah.
You're in too deep when that's happening.
Yeah, it's like the 20 minutes it takes to charge the watch, they're like freaking out for the whole time until they get it back on.
But I saw that when I did, I told you about that math exam where I asked people to surrender their phones and put them in a box in front of the room.
Yeah.
And they spent the entire time looking at the box and almost nobody completed the maths paper. That's all they could think about.
That's ridiculous, yeah. You should have. There was the gig we went to yesterday. No mobile phones were allowed or photography. Until like the last song, and they're like, "Oh yeah, everyone can get their phones out now." Like everyone.
Really?
So you can record this last song if you want. Yeah. I mean, I did. I took some photos because I didn't have any of the rest of the event, so I was guilty of it as well. But everyone literally was like straight out their pockets and like filming the whole event.
Okay. Did people generally obey that? Or?
No, I was literally tapping Helen on the shoulder. I was like, because they literally said, if we see you with your phone out, we're going to kick you out the event.
Yeah.
Like, we don't allow it.
Yeah.
People still did it because they were so desperate to have their phone out. Yeah. I was just tapping Helen on the shoulder and pointing throughout the show. I was like, there's another one.
Someone else with their phone.
it's madness.
The conversation turns to tech anxiety and the general fear people have in losing their phones.
I think that some people have got to the point where it's physically impossible for them to be away from their phone.
Mm. It's become like a body part for some people.
Yeah.
It's like if their phone battery dies, it's like the end of their life, almost, that the way they react.
I guess they just haven't thought through the contingencies of what's going to realistically happen and what's the worst case scenario. So your phone's gone. Yeah. So what?
Mm.
I mean,
it's situational, I suppose. Like, if you're in a desert in the middle of nowhere and you're like, the phone was your last hope of contact to human, like, rescue.
Maybe.
Then, you could justify, like, panicking about that. But when you're literally at home or at the park with some friends that also have phones that have got batteries, you know, if they needed to call for an emergency.
Yeah.
And they're still panicking that their phone's died. It's like, that's a problem. It's become like a safety mechanism.
Well, what did you think of the talk that Kate did about attachment?
That was really interesting. Yeah, it's what was that? She raised that point about especially in children, and it's not just like when it becomes a problem as a child, your brain's not fully developed.
Yeah.
It's much more dangerous, isn't it? Because that becomes like normal for them as a child. It's like the parents that throw iPads at kids to like stop them from screaming or shouting at them. They're like, I'll just go and like watch some YouTube or something or play a game. Then as they get older, that's like they don't know any different. It's like learning to walk or ride a bike
and
using a phone every day. It's like that's not a natural thing, but it is becoming a natural thing.
A new psychological attachment appendage.
Yeah.
And then when you take those things away, it really traumatises people. Mm. It's literally like losing a parent or a brother or something.
Yeah. It's like if I've lost my phone, I'll just be like, where did I leave that? Spend like a few hours trying to find it or eventually find it. But the reaction from... I'm not going to name anyone, but there was a friend of mine who literally lost their phone whilst I was with them, and they were like, went into a full panic, like physical symptom panic of like hyperventilating and like stressing, running around trying to where did I leave the phone? Did I leave it? It was in their back pocket, but
I think there's a name for it. It's like something like no phobia or something.
Yeah,
it's like the fear of losing your phone.
Yeah, phomobia. It's not.
Something like that.
Yeah. I know what you mean. Yeah. Yeah, it's not not healthy because it's more than just so far we've spoken about it as like a immediate problem with like their reaction and things like that. But it's a long term. Like your brain is programmed to see that as an essential need, whether they emotionally think it or not. In the forefront of their mind, they'll be like, no, don't be silly. But their brain is like, if we don't have that thing, we're not safe. So it's a lot deeper than we've said so far in terms of like, you know, like the joke I just made about the initial panic and things like that. It's not just that, it's the dependency of it for some people is like a traumatizing experience.
Yeah.
And their brain is programmed to. It's almost like you've lost your child at the park.
People grieve.
Yeah.
Right? And they get over stuff.
It's almost
they adapt
like
and change. So what? How long do you think it takes? I mean, if you took a phone away from a modern, Homo digitus, whatever the modern person is, that's half half cyborg. How long I mean, people even adapt to the fact that they've had an arm amputated.
Well, we're going to have those group meetings that you do for like drug addicts.
Yeah.
It's going to be. But see, it sounds like a joke now, but it's, you know, it's actually really dangerous, and people just think, oh, don't be silly, whatever. I'm addicted.
In this segment, Ed and Andy are talking about digital resilience.
Well, it's a great cyber weapon, right? Let's say that you wanted to destabilise a population prior to invasion or something else. Mm. If you just switch off all their phones, I mean, regardless of the fact
that... disarray.
It would absolutely cause chaos, wouldn't it? I mean, imagine, but it would be, what's the correct word in sort of psyops? Demoralising. Mm. It's a demoralising act. So what you do is you sap the will of the enemy by sowing chaos and demoralisation. Mm. You could switch people's phones off for a week. Mm. I mean, even if the rest of the services carried on working, like the food deliveries and, you know, society kind of carried on as normal.
Yeah.
Helen was breaking it, bread and circuses. She kept going back to that. She said, well, the bread is the fact that we have this resilience problem of relying on just-in-time delivery and digital systems and stuff. Yeah. That's very scary because you can imagine what would happen if the food stopped coming. Mm-hmm. But before... my question was, what would kick in first, the bread or the circuses? So if you took people's digital nunus away, what would be their... And she was very much the circuses. They would be pissed off that they couldn't get Netflix within, like, about 8 hours.
Yeah.
You know, that would be the big problem.
Well, you've seen... that sort of study I did on resilience with like big tech services, the amount of services that rely on like just AWS, for example. The other day we had another outage. It was only for 5 minutes, but like every IT per like forum and everything, it was like AWS is down. This is down. This is down. This is down. Absolute
mass
panic everywhere. It's like, oh no, we've got all the tickets coming in from the service desk saying that our stuff stopped working.
Flurry of activity.
And they're kind of putting that whole force majeure thing. It's like, oh, it was Amazon, we can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, every single time. And that was 5 minutes. Can you imagine like an hour or
a few days,
2 hours or a day even? Yeah. Like, a day would be like ridiculous.
I lived through the winter of discontent. Do you know what that is?
I've heard you say that phrase before. You have to remind me.
It was in the 70s. It was about 75, 76. So I was just a kid. I was just like 5 or 6 years old. Right? And what happened is the power went off.
Oh, the power. The power grid. Yeah.
And it went off for 3 days at a time.
Yeah.
I was a 3-day working week. And what that meant is that for the other 4 days, the power may or may not be on. And we spent many, many nights by candlelight and oil lamp. Mm. We had to do the washing by hand in the sink. Mm. We hung it out to dry. We lit candles and played card games. I remember my folks staying up. They were all happy as anything. There was all my mum and dad and all the mates from the village.
Yeah.
They were all drinking this. Oh my God, what was it? it was basically cannabis wine. They brewed this. Beer or wine that was like, you know, with dope in it. Yeah. Village moonshine. That was, and they were happy as anything. And I just remember them all downstairs laughing, sitting around oil lamps. And there was no panic. Right? No. I mean, the power was off half a week.
Yeah.
And people just got on with shit and they didn't have the TV. And this is only the 1970s. Mm. It's not that long ago.
I mean, I suppose if that was to happen now, the difference would be, you know, in terms of electricity, even as a supply, we are so dependent on... let's just say the internet goes out, the electricity's fine.
Yeah.
If national internet communications or just, like, you know, main exchanges in London went down...
Yeah.
The amount of reliance we have on those networks today would just... The financial ruin of some companies, they'd go under in that space of 3 days.
But the average person... would survive.
Well, yeah, we would have to go on to those companies like Tesco that have just-in-time delivery service, as you like mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
That would just shut down. There would have to be...
It would.
They would call in all their staff members. They'd have to do manual stock takes.
Have to start doing manual stock takes.
And they'd have to shut all the self-service
tills. They'd find out that nobody has any basic arithmetic.
Yeah, they 90% of their staff, except, like, the 70-year-old Dave that they've had for, like, 40 years as a staff member. Yeah. Nobody else can do the arithmetic. So he's going around the shop doing it all. He's like, oh, I remember doing this as a kid.
The only kind of think, so there's a big distance between 1976 and say 2026, right? When something like that could happen. But I don't know, in the back of my mind is always the thought that people are very resilient when the shit hits the fan.
Yeah.
We adapt much quicker than we imagine. In a way, look at how quickly people adapted to COVID. It was like, oh, there's this massive pandemic of a virus. Everyone's got to stay indoors. OK, then. Really quite quickly. It's like, OK, then. So that's, and the phrase is the new normal.
Yeah.
The new normal suddenly came along. And, and then if you have a modicum of faith in civic structure, in the government, the ability of the army to hand out food from trucks.
Yeah.
I mean, that you could have 4 months of that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is enough of a food supply. God knows what happens after that.
Yeah.
Like, then it's really, really ugly.
Yeah.
But, you know, you could imagine, like, a few months of, OK, you're going to be eating MREs. Like, everybody's going to be warming shit up, you know. eating pot noodles, basically.
And then after those 4 months, you're bashing Mavis on the head for a tin of beans or something. We don't know what's going to happen after that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's... yeah, people adapt, but I think it's just the grieving process, as you say, of that just stopping suddenly.
Yeah, it would be grieving. Oh my god, I've got no, you know, my Netflix is gone, my Xbox is gone, all of that stuff that was my massive comfort zone has gone, and now what? And I think that's the really interesting question. People are suddenly exposed to reality and it's all its raw brutality.
Yeah.
I've got to talk to people. I've got to actually... I've got to engage with them to get the things that I want and need.
Yeah.
I've got to negotiate.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Why can't I just press a button and have the convenience?
Yeah, it's like, do I have to phone them? Can I not just send an email? It's like, what? But people like my mum, who didn't grow up as... You know, she was born in 1970.
Yeah.
But she... went to school and didn't... Computers weren't... Yeah, I think in senior school they had, like, one computer. And she's used, like, CAD programs for tie design, things like that, but she's had no reliance on it.
Right.
So she'd be able... You know, overnight, she'd go back to reading and sending letters in the post.
Yeah. I would too. It's like your mum and my generation is... Yeah. Just, we would just fall back to our skills immediately.
I remember, like, last week I had to reboot the firewall at home because I did a software update. And it takes, like, 5 minutes because I had to cache all the, like, settings and everything.
Yeah.
Within about 2 minutes, my sister's bedroom door opened, came down the stairs, and was like, the internet's gone off. And I know, I just rebooted it. You have to wait 5 minutes. 2 minutes later, my brother came out of his room and was like, the internet's gone off. I'm like, what?
Well, at least you know how to get their attention.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, nice to see you. I haven't seen you in a week. I'm a little bit like that. I seem to be... Naturally, throughout the day, I've got this, like, quite high level of stress. I don't have any particular reason for it that I can think of. And then when it gets to night and, like, the sun's gone down, I know everyone's gone to bed at home.
Right, and you just...
I'll get this second wind of, like, energy.
Okay.
And that's when I'll do work.
I noticed that. Because I know when you're logged in, I can just see like, suddenly all this stuff starts coming through.
Yeah.
And, I can, like, kind of... I know at midnight and suddenly Ed's going to kind of light up and there's going to be...
Yeah. I don't know what it is. It's like... But I haven't always been like that. Usually I was a morning person.
Do you think a lot of hackers are like that? I don't know, because it's a bit of a stereotype of, like...
Up at night, yeah.
Up at night, you know.
Yeah, maybe. It's sort of like, you know... There's, like, this sense of calmness when you know the rest of the sort of areas in, like, calmness, asleep and everything.
I totally get that.
You know that everyone around you's, like, either in bed or relaxed or, you know, nothing's going on.
Yeah.
And then you're like... And then you just...
And you come alive.
Yeah.
And I call that the night watch.
Yeah.
I become quite vigilant and mentally active, but in a really good way.
Yeah.
Once I know that everything else has gone to sleep and it's all got turned down, you know.
Yeah. The problem with that is you're expected to be awake during the day as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just tired in the day because you don't fall asleep until like 3-4 in the morning.
Yeah.
Then you're up at like 8-9 and moving about and everything, getting on with stuff.
Mm.
So it's... Just get that constant, like, grogginess, and I don't know. It hasn't been It's only been in the last 2 years that I've been like that, really. Usually I'd get on with things in the day just as much as I would at night, but
yeah.
I don't know. I think it's stress-related somehow.
I think the theme for our On The Go today is going to be technology and mental health, isn't it? It took until the end of Helen and my walk that we got back to my house and we had a packet of crisps and a cup of coffee with Kate, and she said, "What were you talking about today?"
Mm.
And we sort of looked at each other, me and Helen looked at it and said, like, it was kind of like about work and women's rights.
Yeah.
And then they said, okay, that's it, that's what it was. That's the title we'll give to that episode.
Yeah, I suppose, you sort of know all conversations naturally come to some sort
of... They come to a place, yeah. It's a good subject. A lot of hackers suffer mental health problems.
Mm.
A lot of people that are in IT.
Yeah.
It's very stressful. You know, I want to keep Hassan and Ahmed and Francis very, very much in the loop and sort of hear their stories.
Yeah.
And all their war stories and gripes.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be very valuable.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
But I was thinking of kind of sysadmin war stories.
Yeah.
I think loads of listeners will be interested in mental health and cyber stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
Partly because it is very taxing on us as practitioners.
Mm.
Because you knew about computers, every fucker that you met would say, "Oh, can you fix my computer?"
Yeah, I still get that now.
"Oh, can you fix my..." And there were, I even had a T-shirt, I think I got from Slashdot or something like that. And it was just one of these sort of plain black T-shirts with the white writing on it.
It says, "No, I can't fix
your computer." No, I won't fix you. Yeah. I can't fix your computer.
Yeah.
And that was my, not only a treasured T-shirt, but an actual defence. It's almost like, I don't know, you're burdened with this responsibility for sorting everybody else's shit out.
Mm. Yeah.
And it activates a certain reward centre in your brain as an intelligent, capable person who wants to feel useful and help out.
Yeah.
It pushes all your buttons. And so I think what happened is that tech support for the vast majority of the population was just a free community service from your local tech capable person, your older brother or whatever, who knew how to do stuff.
Do it for a beer.
And that happened, I don't know, like sort of 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
And at some point, all the people like us who used to fix everyone else's shit just got bored with it.
Yeah.
And said, "You know what? Just get Google, go on Facebook or something, because I can't be bothered cleaning up your mess anymore.
Mm.
Can't be bothered wiping your ass, defragging your disk drive, and all the things."
Can't remember the last time I defragged a disk drive, actually. No, all solid state.
But that used to be the thing. So, my disk needs defragging. Yeah. Really?
I saw there was someone put a meme in an IT group that said, "I defragged your Zebra," and it's like white and then black. Taking all the stripes out, it's just white and black.
Hi, you're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk. I'm Helen Blees, signing off. Thanks for listening.